Genesis chapter 37. Closing in on the end of our stroll through the book of Genesis. And today we're going to be starting to look at the final main character of Genesis, a man by the name of Joseph. Titled the message, and we probably don't have a title slide. Probably just as well. Titled the message, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor. There you go. People who know have no clue who Joseph is, know that because of the play or whoever played. So we're in Genesis chapter 37, starting in verse 1. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. These are the family records of Jacob. At 17 years of age, Joseph tended sheep with his brothers. The young man was working with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. They weren't actually wives, they were concubines. And he brought a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph more than his other sons because Joseph was a son born to him in his old age. And he made a robe of many colors for him. There's the technicolor dream go. When the brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not bring themselves to speak peaceably to him. So as I said, we've come to the last major character of the book of Genesis, Joseph. You know, it's interesting, of all the people we've looked at, I mean, from Adam and Eve and all the way through, and then Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, no one in the entire book of Genesis has more written about him than Joseph. Only a quarter of the book of Genesis is about this man, Joseph. We're going to take 3 weeks to look at his life. We could take an entire 3 or 4 month series to look at Joseph's life. He's just an amazing man. He's actually in many respects a copy of Jesus Christ. I'm not going to get into that, but you can study that for yourself. So since we last looked at Jacob, who was running from his brother Esau because he had tricked him, Jacob had cheated Esau, his twin brother, of both the birthright and the blessing. And Jacob then goes to his uncle, Laban, about 500-600 miles away. Very difficult journey. He gets there, he meets Rachel. Rachel, I mean, it's love at first sight. He just immediately calls her my own Rachel. He fell so hard for her that when he asked Laban for her hand in marriage, Laban says, well, sure, but you got to work for me for 7 years. And Jacob said, sure, no problem. So 7 years went by, the wedding came, woke up the next morning, and it wasn't Rachel, it was Leah, Rachel's oldest sister, and tricked her. So we went back to Laban and said, you tricked me. I still want to marry Rachel. This is Genesis. This is really early in human history. They did weird things back then. Okay? So he goes and says, oh, I still want to marry Rachel. And Laban said, not a problem. You can work for another 7 years for her. And Jacob said, okay, that's what it takes. That's what I'll do. And so Laban allowed him to marry Rachel, but then said, you've got to work for me for 7 years. At the end of that, 14 years now, working for his two wives. He goes to Laban and says, you know, maybe it's time for me to go home. And Laban says, no. Laban understands that even though Jacob is probably not the perfect son-in-law, he understands that Jacob's presence in camp is about God's blessing. But Laban says, I can't let you leave because your presence here is making me rich. So Jacob says, that's not a problem. I'll work for wages now. And being the trickster he is, he says, I'll take all the spotted and speckled sheep, and you take the regular ones, and circles up so that all the sheep can supply these vessels. And Laban and Jacob go through these agreements, I think, 10 times. And we change it. And Jacob became more and more and more wealthy. And finally, by the end, after about 20 years there, Jacob realizes that his brothers, Leah and Rachel's brothers, are really angry because they believe that he's taking all of their wealth. He's getting all of their father's wealth, and they're going to be left without an inheritance. So he heads back towards his father's home down in the land of Judea. Now, in the time since marrying Leah and Rachel, he had also taken two concubines, a servant, Rachel's servant, and Leah's servant. So he now has four wives, and he's got 12 sons and at least one daughter. Almost the youngest is Joseph. Joseph, Jacob says, is the son of my old age. Actually, he has another son, Benjamin. Benjamin and Jacob are brothers. Their mother Rachel dies in childbirth. But Jacob, he really prefers Joseph. All the kids, Joseph is his preference. Parents, be really careful about playing favorites. This whole story that we're about to read, God uses it. I mean, He really uses it. We're not going to see today the story unfold in the way that God uses this, but the entire story, the last quarter of the book of Genesis, really comes from conflict between brothers that's caused by Jacob playing favorites. Everything else comes from that. Now, if you're a parent and you've got many kids, now if you only got one kid, one child, that child is yours. But if you've got more than one child, you may naturally, as a parent, be drawn to one more than another. One child may be more like your personality, or there might be something about that child that draws you, moms and dads both. In Isaac's case, Jacob's father, Jacob's mother was really, he was her favorite, and Isaac's favorite was Esau. There's a whole family history of playing favorites. But Jacob sets up some really horrible family dynamics by choosing one of his sons as his favorite and then letting all the rest of the kids know. Let me just very quickly make some suggestions to parents on how to not show your kids that one of them is a favorite. First of all of your children, even though every one of them is unique, none of your kids is alike. All of your children have praiseworthy attributes. Pick out those praiseworthy attributes. Let that child know what they are. Celebrate those things. Look for their strengths and celebrate their strengths. Look for their interests and celebrate their interests. And here's the thing. As a parent, recognize that this child is created by God in the way that he or she is. Whatever those traits, whatever that personality, whatever those interests, they come from God. Now, they may not be your interests, but that child's interests and everything about that kid is created by God. And so, if you reject one child because that child is not like his brothers or his sisters or her brothers or sisters, if you really begin playing favorites, what you're actually saying to God is, God, I don't really think you did a very good job in creating this child. So, find those praiseworthy attributes and concentrate on them. Talk about and be proud of who God made them to be. Secondly, unconditionally love your kids. Some kids, by nature, are going to be more difficult than others. you have a difficult child, know this. Difficulty you're having with that child comes from personality traits that when God molds and will be strengths. God molds and shapes those things that you find difficult. Strength. And so unconditionally love that child. Alert, be alert to what your kids are sensitive about. You know, Connie told me that somebody expressed some surprise this week that I was actually surviving my week, first and second grade. Me and children have never been. I don't know what to say. Young children, I've never understood. I mean, is this thing, if you take a 3-year-old and you sit down and try to have a rational conversation? I don't understand. I remember with one of our kids, one of our boys, probably about 2, and did something wrong, and so I sat in on a chair and was having a rational conversation. Honey, well, I'm trying to help Nathan understand what he's wrong. You know how old he is? Next to his problem. We need to get something along with that wall. And so somebody expressed some surprise this week that both kids and I were surviving. Both kids and I were surviving. But you know what? Maybe it comes with you appreciate, even though they need me really. I've learned to appreciate children, and I've learned to appreciate the differences in kids. When my kids were young, I tried to relate to them by teasing them. Because I didn't know what else to do. But unfortunately, my teasing wounded them because I was not sufficiently sensitive to how they were receiving. Be alert to areas of sensitivity in each of your kids. Every one of them is going to be different. Each child will be different in different areas of sensitivity. And never, ever, ever attack them in those areas of sensitivity when you're. Be consistent from one child to another. My brother and sister, who's just a year and a half younger than me, after we were all adults, we went to our mom and dad and said, why did you treat our youngest sister so different? You let her get away with all this stuff that you would never let us get away with. Well, why did you do that? And mom and dad said, we were too tired. And so there will be differences, and you change and you're different, but try to be consistent in your childhood. If Jacob had done maybe even one or two of those things, the last part of the book of Genesis wouldn't be there. Because everything we find from chapter 37 through chapter 50 flows from Jacob playing favorites and saying, Joseph. Well, anyhow, that's really good stuff, I think, but it's not today's message. We're really focusing on Joseph, who was about 17 at the time that we read this. His brothers hate him. He's daddy's favorite. For most of his life, he's been the youngest of kids. If the events in Genesis are chronological, as we would write them, the youngest brother, Benjamin, is only about a year old. Their mother, Rachel, has died in childbirth. And it seems as though Joseph, even though he's 17, a 17-year-old brat. Now, you might be able to understand that somewhere. I mean, he's been spoiled by dad. His mom's dead. And his brothers hate him. But there, it still is. He's a brat. Now, why would I say that? Well, first of all, in the first few verses that I already read, we find that Joseph went out to the fields where his half-brothers, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, were, and he looked at what they were doing, and he brought a bad report back to Dad. Now, it seems as though that his father had actually assigned him the task of going out and checking on his brothers and bringing the report back. And that's just one more nail in Jacob's coffin. You don't do that. You especially don't do that with the youngest kid and have the youngest kid set up as a spy over the older kids. It's a great way to cause conflict. Jacob's just setting Joseph up. But there seems to be something else going on here. The Hebrew word that we translate report has the sense of something that is not fully true. Now, those of you who are the oldest of multiple siblings, any oldest kids in here? Yeah. Did your brother or sister ever go to mom and dad and tell them something that was partially true? And in doing that, really got you in trouble? Any youngest kids in here? How many of you have done that to your older brothers and sisters? Yeah, I'm the oldest of four. I can tell you all about younger siblings going to mom and dad. Kenny did this, Kenny did, oh wait a minute, how about what you did? I've got a brother that's about 4 years younger than me, so I'm 16 years old. I've got my own car. I spent my money for. And I had learned over the years that if Keith and I had kind of a ruckus, that I'd better not do anything to him because I'd get in trouble. It didn't matter what he did. I was going to get in trouble. So we had something going on, and I don't have any clue what it was. It was probably nothing. And so I run into my car, and I jumped in my car, and I slammed the door and locked it because I knew that if he hit me, I was going to hit him back. And if I hit him back, I was going to be in real trouble. So I jump in the door, jump in the car, and slam the door and lock it, and now you can't get to me. He took a swing of his foot. Boom! He kicked a huge dent in my car door, which I had bought with my money, and for which I was paying the insurance and the gas. Guess who got in trouble? Me. I still don't understand that. I don't get to see my brother very often. We actually have a great senior. But when I do, I will occasionally remember that I hold him some. And one of these days, I'm going to collect. But that seems to be what Joseph was doing. He goes out to the fields, and he comes back and says, "Hey, Dad, I just wanted to let you know, my brothers, they're not doing a real good job." Again, that word that we see that was translated report is a report that is not fully true. Joseph is a brat. Verse 5. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. There we were binding sheaves of grain in the field. Suddenly my sheaf stood up, and your sheaves gathered round it and bowed down to my sheaf. Are you really going to reign over us?" his brothers asked him. "Are you really going to rule us?" So they hated him even more because of his dream and what he had said. Then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Look," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." He told his father and brothers, but his father rebuked him. "What kind of dream is this that you have had?" he said. "Are your mother and brothers and I going to come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father. Let me suggest this to you. First of all, Where did Joseph's dreams come from? God. Joseph's dreams came from God. Now, we don't know it in chapter 37, but let me tell you that his dreams came true. We just can't see that in chapter 37. And so his dreams are truth, and they are from God. Let me suggest to you that if God gives you special insight and knowledge about something, you do not necessarily have to share that with anyone. You might want to just keep your mouth shut. To whom did God give the dream? Did he give it to his brothers? Did he give it to his dad? Did he give it to anybody else? It was for Joseph. And we're going to find out in the next couple of weeks why this dream was important. It was something for Joseph to hang on to as life went on for him. There was nothing in that dream that said, go to church. Nothing in the dream that said, go tell your brothers this. Now, Joseph is a 17-year-old immature brat. So bear with me. We don't know what tone of voice he used. Here's what I'm guessing that conversation went like. Hey, Judah, Reuben, guess what I dreamed last night? I dreamed we were all in the field gathering the wheat, and my sheaf stood up and your sheaves bowed down. What do you think of that, Reuben? Can you imagine him doing that? Even if Joseph didn't tell about his dream quite that way, his brothers knew what the dream meant. Joseph was telling them he was more important. They already knew that their father felt that way. The amazing Technicolor dream coat simply proved what they already knew. And by the way, the coat, some scholars believe, coat just by the description and knowing some archaeological culture, that the typical person, shepherd working in the field, to wear a coat that had very short and no sleeve, was short to be allowed to work in the field easily. But they, some scholars believe that this coat probably had long sleeves and was a very long coat because that's what nobles and kings wore. Remember, God has promised Jacob that from you, your descendants will become. And understand, I'm not teaching the doctrine here. I'm just saying this is what could have been going on. Jacob could have been looking at Joseph and saying, this is the first king of the lineage. The rest of you, they don't count so much. Then Joseph adds insult to injury by reporting the second dream. This time, dreams of the sun and the moon and stars, the 11 stars, instead of here. The 11 stars bowed down to him. Now even Jacob has had enough if he rebukes Joseph. But he rebukes him for the wrong thing. From whom did the dream come? God. Was it true? You got to know what happens to the rest of Jacob. Yes, it's true. Jacob doesn't, what he should have rebuked Joseph for was his, Joseph, listen, buddy, young man, there are some things you don't need to say. When God gives you a dream, don't hold that over your brothers. That's what he should have said. Instead, he doesn't do that. He says, what do you think's going on? You think that me, your father, is going to bow down? That was so countercultural. The son never bowed down to the father. I'm sorry, his father never bowed down to the son. The son always bowed to the father. And so there's this thing that Jacob says, what do you think you're doing? That I'm going to bow down to you? He chastises Joseph for the wrong thing. He shouldn't have said, you shouldn't have told anybody, buddy. Instead, he says, you got it wrong. remember, this is Jacob who has had multiple visitations from God himself. He has seen God at Bethel. God told him specifically, go back to Bethel, and there he met with him. The angel of the Lord, in a separate occasion we didn't talk about, the angel of the Lord met with him, and they struggled, they wrestled all night. Jacob has had these interactions, these encounters, this relationship with God, but Jacob doesn't see the truth. You know, I said today is about Joseph, and it really is, but there's something about Jacob we really need to see. Jacob misses the truthfulness of what Joseph is given by God. Can't see it. He can't see it because of his own cultural worldview. I sometimes wonder what truth I miss because it doesn't fit the way I see the world. Jacob couldn't get it because in his worldview, just the things were organized, fathers don't bow down to sons. So he just, this can't be true. Parents, be very careful. Do not miss God's plan for your children because it doesn't fit the way you've organized your world. I wonder how many young people God has called to special places of service in His kingdom that never arrive at their destination because their parents couldn't see it. And I'm grateful, and I mention my mom and dad often because I'm so grateful to. One of the things I'm grateful to mom and dad is that they never said to me or my brother or my sisters, you can't achieve that. You can't do that. Or never said, that's what I'm not going to do. They made sure I had the opportunity to be in the right places to hear God's voice. I was filled with the baptism of the Holy Spirit at our version of Bible camp when I was 13. I was called to public ministry a few years later at Bible camp. You need to understand that my parents never discouraged that. It took a long time for that calling to be fulfilled. Partially because I couldn't see the truth of that. I was raised in an environment where if anybody in pulpit ministry evangelistic, fiery kind of preacher, in my own personality. I looked at these creatures and said, I can never do that because that's not who I am. And I limited God. And God took me on a journey that eventually resulted in becoming a pastor. But when I was 16 or 17 at Bible camp, feeling this call of God, I thought the only possible way for that to be fulfilled in my life was as the ministry of music. Because I had some musical talent, and I enjoy leading worship, and I enjoyed that kind of thing. And so I thought, well, that's naturally what God's going to do. And I went to Bible college. My parents supported me. They say to me, you need to go someplace where you can learn to. Bible college, I discovered that musical talent was really great. But more importantly, I discovered that prepared me years ago. That's the role of home. When I eventually, when my younger brother, when he went to the about 20 years ago, he said, when I was in my 40s, I called mom and dad and said, you know, after the first career, successful consulting business, God was calling me to pastoral ministry. That's what they just accepted that their children. Okay, verse 12 through the end of the chapter. His brothers had gone to pasture their father's flocks at Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Your brothers, you know, are pasturing the flocks at Shechem. Get ready, I'm sending you to them." "I'm ready," Joseph replied. Israel said to him, "And go see how your brothers and the flocks are doing, and then bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. A man pounding there, wandering in the field, said, "What are you looking for?" "Well, I'm looking for my brothers," Joseph said. "Can you tell me where they have their flocks? They've moved on from here." The man said, "I heard them say, let's go to Dothan." So Joseph said after his brothers, "We found them at Dothan." They saw him in the distance, and before he had reached them, they plotted to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes that dreamer. Come on, let's kill him and throw him into one of the pits. We can say that a vicious animal. Then we'll see what becomes of their dreams." Reuben heard this. Reuben's the oldest of the sons. He tried to save him from them. He said, "Let's not take his life." Reuben also said to them, "Don't shed blood. Throw him in the pit in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him." He intended to rescue him from their hands and return him to the father, their father. When Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped off his robe, the robe of many colors he had on. They took him and threw him into the pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. They sat down to eat a meal. They looked up, and there was a caravan of Ishmaelites, actually their cousins, coming from Gilead. Their camels were carrying aromatic gum, balsam, resin, going to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What do we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, not lay a hand on him. He is our brother, our own flesh." They all agreed. When Midianite traders passed by, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the pit and sold him for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took Joseph to Egypt. Reuben returned to the pit, saw that Joseph was not there. He tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone. What am I going to do?" So they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a young goat, dipped the robe in his blood, sent the robe of many colors to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it. Is your son's robe or not?" His father recognized it. "It's my son's robe," he said. "A vicious animal has devoured him. Joseph has been torn to pieces." Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth around his waist, and mourned for his sons many days. So all of his sons and daughters tried to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. No, he said, "I will go down to Sheol to my son, mourning." He prayed. His father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard. There are so many things here, but I just want to mention two of them. First, no matter what the provocation, there is absolutely no excuse for what the brothers do. In their minds, they rationalize their actions based on what Joseph and his father did. It's okay if we kill him because he's a dreamer and he's just making errors, and so our father has preferred him, and that's not right, and so it's okay for me. Yes, their father has played favorites. Yes, their little brother told tales about them. Yes, he rubbed their noses in the future. But those are not the things that drove the brothers to this decision to, first of all, kill Joseph and then sell him. What really motivated them was bitterness, envy, and jealousy. Horrible, destructive things. They wanted what Joseph had. It wasn't Joseph's fault that Jacob had played favorites. It wasn't his fault that he was the youngest. But they took their bitterness over their own rejection, and they turned it on Joseph. That's what happens when bitterness and envy is allowed to grow and flourish. It's easy to become bitter over things that people, sometimes intentional, sometimes unintentional. It's easy to become bitter. It's easy to become envious when others seem to succeed. No matter how hard you try, you just can't get there from here. It's easy to become envious and jealous. And when that happens, you have a choice. Your choice is to take that bitterness or that envy and to turn it inward and to mull it over and to dwell on it, or your choice is to release it to God. And if you choose to sit on it, if you choose to take it into your spirit, if you choose to dwell on it, you never know what might happen. You might also become a murderer. James writes in his epistle, "What is the source of wars and fights among you? Don't they come from the cravings that are at war within you?" What are those cravings? Cravings. Jealousy, bitterness, resentment. And we have a choice. We can sit on those things, we can dwell on them, we can look at them, we can kind of take them inside of our brain and shut our eyes and have them plastered on the insides of our eyelids. Or we can say, "God, truth is I wasn't treated fairly, but I released that to you. You are my sword, my shield, you are my strength, you are my..." Your choice. Second thing, and this one this just blows my mind. Listen closely. Would you say that Joseph's 11 brothers are evil? I would. It's a pretty evil thing to plot to kill your brother. I mean, it's one thing to do it in the heat of a moment. I'm not trying to kill my brother. It's his own fault. We were fighting in the garage. I think I told this story. Something. We were fighting in the garage, and of course, I was bigger and stronger. Years older. So I get on top of him and say, "Uncle, it's you, you still, when you're fighting, you still say, no, don't answer me. Say, uncle," that's what we used to do. "Say, uncle," and he said, "Uncle, I'm ready to talk to you." That cannot go on. So I jumped him again, did that about 3 times, and I said, "Now listen. Forgiveness. Probably it. I'll let you up. Kick me. Let him up and kick me. I'm going to start slamming his head. Don't ever do that, young people. Forgive." Fortunately, my grandmother, who walked with me, saved me. And me. I think these were pretty evil men. They didn't, it wasn't the heat of the moment. It was a planned thing. They saw Joseph when he was a long way away and said, "How can we plot to kill him and pass it off as though a wild..." They had a plan. This was done in cold blood. And then what really gets me is once they got Joseph and they put him in the pit, they sit down and have a meal. "Here, Reuben, you want bologna or cheese?" Anybody remember the Mountain Dew? Joseph's down in the pit saying, "Hey, guys! Cupcakes after the meal's over." I mean, this is cold-blooded kind of stuff. They're evil men. So I want you to keep that in mind. I want you to see this. Go to the very end of the Bible, Revelation 20. "Then one of the seven angels who held the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came and spoke with me. Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. He carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem," this is the new Jerusalem, "coming down out of heaven from God. It was arrayed with God's glory. Her radiance was like a very precious stone, like a jasper stone, bright as crystal. The city had a massive high wall with 12 gates. 12 angels were at the gates. The names of the 12 tribes of Israel were inscribed on the gates. These 11 incredibly evil men for eternity have their names inscribed in the gates of the New Jerusalem." Talk about God's grace. If it were me, What you just did to your brother, you're out of it, buddy. You conspired to kill your youngest brother. You dwelt on your anger and you came up with a plan and then you sold him as a slave and then you lied to your dad. None of them. Aren't you glad that God's not me? I'm not God. You're not God. Because when we're ready to write somebody else off, God says, I am now. That's when my grace becomes sufficient. Now we're going to see the brothers change. Something happens in their life before God says, I'm going to write their name. They change. They hadn't changed yet. I love the end of the story. Connie gets mad at me sometimes because I'll read the book and I'll turn to the last chapter. I want to know how it is. Bible lets me know how it is. Joseph couldn't see how it ended. Jacob couldn't see how it ended. At this point, Reuben and Judah and Simeon and Issachar and all the rest of them, they didn't know how it ended. They didn't even know that God was being graceful to them. They had no idea that his grace was being extended to them. But that's what God does. In the midst of wherever it is that you and I are in life, God's grace becomes extended and we don't even know it. But you see, it's in those moments, these guys, their lives did change. It took a long time. Their lives changed. Friends, I don't know where all of you are in your relationship with Jesus Christ. It could be that God's grace is being extended to you right now. Extended his grace. Reuben and Issachar and Simeon. Maybe you're at that place that you need his grace. Let me tell you that grace is there. See what happens in the end of the story. That's the end. Recognize that. Maybe what you need to do is ask. Lord, I thank you that your word is full of people whom you extend grace. I thank you for that because we are imperfect people whom you extend grace. Oh, maybe none of us have ever plotted to kill our brother. Maybe none of us have ever done the things that these brothers did. Yet, the smallest of things, what we would call a small thing, a small sin, separates us from you just as much as murder. We need your grace, Lord. We need your love and forgiveness. Perhaps there is somebody who's sitting here who has never said, God, I ask that you forgive me all the times that I sin. Lord, I pray right now that your spirit acts and encourage them to see. As that person does that, experience the depth of your love. Perhaps, Lord, there are others of us who have, at times in our lives, past, come to you and said, please forgive me, but we've allowed the things of life to get in our way and sin against you, sin against others. Lord, if that is true for anyone, we're in prayer. Extended so that we can turn and say, then make right. And again, Lord, perhaps it's not one of these really huge things that we say, oh, that's wrong. It's just, I can't understand. Perhaps it's what we would call small sin. Or there is no small sin. You are absolutely holy. The smallest, say, small. You as much as it. So we all need you. All need you. Thank you. God, for your Son Jesus Christ. Lord, again, I thank you for your word and for the power of your ability of our lives.